and would have to fork over Gilead's exorbitant price tag on a product U.S. taxpayers had by then spent at least $85 million to develop. Improving Gilead's business even more, doctors and hospitals that failed to use remdesivir could now be sued for malpractice, leading some medical experts to believe that coercing the use of this worthless and dangerous drug on COVID patients almost certainly cost tens of thousands of Americans their lives. As we shall see, Dr. Fauci copied the choreographed script for winning remdesivir's EUA from the worn, rabbit-eared playbook that he developed during his early AIDS years and then used repeatedly across his career to win approvals for deadly and ineffective drugs. Time and again, he has terminated clinical trials of his sweetheart drugs the moment they begin to reveal cataclysmic toxicity. He makes the absurd claim that his drug du jour had proven so miraculously effective that it would be unethical to deny it to the public, and then he strong-arms FDA to grant his approvals. This time only, the brazenness of the fraud earned Dr. Fauci some rare criticism, even in mainstream science and press, and from academic institutions that customarily maintain silence about his shenanigans, given their addictions to whopping NIH and BMGF funding. On October 24, 2020, Umer Irfan noted that the FDA is once again promoting a COVID-19 therapy based on shaky evidence. The British Medical Journal pointed out, none of the randomized controlled trials published so far, however, have shown that remdesivir saves significantly more lives than standard medical care. Eric Topol of Scripps Research Translational Institute scolded that this is a very, very bad look for the FDA, and the dealings between Gilead and EU make it another layer of badness. Angela Rasmussen, a virologist at Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health, told a reporter, "I was really surprised when I saw that news." Science magazine said Dr. Fauci's move had baffled scientists who have closely watched the clinical trials of remdesivir unfold over the past 6 months and who have many questions about remdesivir's worth. University of Oxford professor of clinical therapeutics Duncan Richard scathingly observed that research based on this kind of use should be treated with extreme caution because there is no control group or randomization, which are some of the hallmarks of good practice in clinical trials. Professor Stephen Evans in pharmacoepidemiology at the Gates-funded London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine offered a particularly scathing assessment. The data from this paper are almost uninterpretable. It is very surprising, perhaps even unethical, that the New England Journal of Medicine has published it. It would be more appropriate to publish the data on the website of the pharmaceutical company that has sponsored and written up the study. At least Gilead has been clear that this has not been done in the way that a high-quality scientific paper would be written. Even Bill Gates raised an eyebrow about the audacity of the caper. When Wired magazine in August 2020 asked Gates what therapeutic treatment he'd ask for if hospitalized with COVID-19, he did not hesitate. "Remdesivir," Gates replied, adding a comment that put daylight between him and the embarrassing clinical trial fiasco. Sadly, the trials in the U.S. have been so chaotic that the actual proven effect is kind of small. Potentially, the effect is much larger than that. It's insane how confused the trials here in the U.S. have been. Then, on October 19, 2020, 3 days before remdesivir's FDA approval, the World Health Organization published a definitive study on remdesivir involving 11,266 COVID-19 patients in 405 hospitals and 30 countries. The power of this study dwarfed the Fauci-Gilead project, which had recruited 1,062 patients. In the WHO's trial, remdesivir failed to reduce mortality, and failed to reduce the need for ventilators or the length of hospital stays. WHO researchers found no detectable benefits from remdesivir and recommended against its use in COVID-19 patients. WHO published its devastating indictment of remdesivir 1 month after FDA issued the remdesivir EUA for children less than 12 years of age. Dr. Fauci and the FDA knew about the WHO study before the FDA issued the EUA for remdesivir and almost certainly read the preprints and understood the findings. It appears, in fact, that Dr. Fauci once again hurried the approval through FDA so as to beat the publication of a negative study. On July 15, 2021, a large Johns Hopkins study in original investigation infectious diseases once again confirmed that remdesivir treatment was not associated with improved survival, but was associated with longer hospital stays. On October 2, 2020, the European Union released its own safety review of remdesivir. The study reported serious side effects. Every independent randomized control trial of remdesivir has shown either a lack of benefit or a clear trend to harm, says Dr. Pierre Corey. It's only those two pharma studies with Dr. Fauci that show any benefits, and even then, the benefits are minor. It makes no sense to give an antiviral in late stages of a viral infection, Dr. Corey adds. The viral replication mainly takes place prior to day 7. If an antiviral works, that's when you administer antivirals. Remdesivir might work early on, but we don't know because it's IV administered, and you can't really do that to ambulatory patients. A remedy worse than the malady. From early in May 2020, doctors and hospitals began using remdesivir on hospitalized patients who tested positive for COVID in PCR tests. By November 9, 2021, the publication date of this book, CDC's website lists only two drugs approved for treating COVID-19, remdesivir and the corticosteroid dexamethasone. Doctors often use the two drugs in conjunction. Assessing remdesivir's impact on hospitalized COVID-19 patients is difficult, in part because, like COVID-19, remdesivir causes extreme toxicity to lungs and kidneys and mimics several of the other lethal symptoms of COVID, including multi-organ failure. Many doctors believe our country's record COVID-19 fatalities are at least in part due to widespread use of remdesivir in 2020. We had the most deaths worldwide, says Dr. Ryan Cole. It's a haunting question. How many of these Americans were remdesivir casualties? For several months, we were the only country treating people with a drug proven to be lethal. That year, 2020, we had almost double the number of deaths per month compared to most other countries. Brazil, one of the first nations to widely use remdesivir, had the second highest death toll. In May of 2020, New York doctors repeatedly marveled at the tendency for COVID-19 to cause kidney failure, something that no other respiratory virus does. Doctors began seeing acute kidney failure on day 3, 4, and 5 after admission. Hospitals short on ventilators also ran out of dialysis machines. Physician and laboratory CEO Dr. Ryan Cole is one of many doctors who believe that many of those cases were attributable to remdesivir. COVID-19 can affect the kidneys, he says. We know this because we can recover the spike protein from urine, but it's dubious that the sheer magnitude of acute renal failure we saw among hospitalized COVID patients can all be attributed solely to the coronavirus infection. Dr. Cole told me that in the animal studies, 1/4 of the animals died from kidney failure. He explains that kidney collapse can lead to fluid accumulations in the lungs and everywhere, and results in multi-organ failure and sepsis, all of which are also sequelae of COVID. Remdesivir shouldn't be on the market, he added. Dr. Fauci's 2019 Ebola study proved that remdesivir by day 3, 4, and 5 caused acute kidney failure in upwards of 31% of patients. In less than 5 days of remdesivir treatment, 8% of all people died or experienced life-threatening multiple organ failure or kidney failure so severe they had to be taken off the drug. So it may not be a coincidence that roughly the same number of hospitalized COVID patients, 8 to 10 times, were dying in the first week, says Cole. Dr. McCullough gives us a stark and clear summary. Remdesivir has two problems. First, it doesn't work. Second, it is toxic and it kills people. 5. Final solution: vaccines or bust. The only means to fight a plague is honesty. Albert Camus, The Plague, 1947. During the spring of 2020, Dr. Fauci and Bill Gates carpet-bombed the airwaves, bearishly predicting that a miraculous vaccine would stop COVID transmission, prevent illness and the pandemic, and release humanity from house arrest. Even vaccinology's most stalwart tub-thumpers, true believers like Dr. Peter Hotez and Dr. Paul Offit, regarded those forecasts as far-fetched and foolhardy. After all, for decades, two perilous and seemingly insurmountable impediments had thwarted every attempt to craft a coronavirus vaccine. Leaky vaccines. The first obstacle was the coronavirus's tendency to rapidly mutate, producing vaccine-resistant variants. Vaccine developers like Hotez and Offit doubted that after decades of futile efforts, researchers could suddenly develop a COVID vaccine that would provide sterilizing immunity, meaning that it would completely obliterate viral colonies in vaccinated individuals and prevent transmission and mutation. As if to confirm such fears, in May of that year, Britain's top vaccinologist, Andrew Pollard, admitted that the Oxford University's government-funded and patriotically ballyhooed AstraZeneca vaccine had failed to achieve sterilizing immunity in monkeys. The inoculated macaques, even when asymptomatic, continued to support high viral loads in their nasal pharynxes. Then, in August, Dr. Fauci primped up the dismaying news of similar failures by all the competing candidates with a kind of celebratory bravado. Instead of declaring defeat and retreating to the drawing board, Dr. Fauci cheerfully announced that none of the first-generation COVID vaccines was likely to prevent transmission. That news should have cratered the entire project. Leading virologists, including Nobel laureate Luc Montagnier, pointed out that a non-sterilizing or leaky vaccine could not arrest transmission and would therefore fail to stop the pandemic. Even worse, vaccinated individuals, he warned, would become asymptomatic carriers and mutant factories, blasting out vaccine-resistant versions of the disease that were likely to lengthen and intensify rather than abbreviate the pandemic. But Tony Fauci and his partner, Bill Gates, seemed to have a strategy for neutralizing the variant threat. The two men had put billions of taxpayer and tax-deducted dollars into developing an mRNA platform for vaccines that, in theory, would allow them to quickly produce new boosters to combat each new escape variant. This scheme was Big Pharma's holy grail. Vaccines are one of the rare commercial products that multiply profits by failing. Each new booster doubles the revenues from the initial jab. Since NIAID co-owned the mRNA patent, the agency stood to make billions from its coronavirus gambit by producing successive boosters for every new variant. The more, the better. The good news for pharma was that all of humanity would be permanently dependent on biannual or even triannual booster shots. Dr. Peter McCullough warned that mass vaccination with a leaky vaccine during a pandemic would put the world on a never-ending booster treadmill. That kind of talk had pharma popping champagne corks. In October 2021, Pfizer announced that it was projecting an astonishing $26 billion in revenues from its COVID boosters. Pathogenic priming. The even more daunting obstacle to coronavirus vaccines was their tendency to induce pathogenic priming, also known as antibody-dependent enhancement, ADE, an overstimulation of immune system response that can cause severe injuries and death when vaccinated individuals subsequently encounter the wild viruses. In early experiments, coronavirus vaccines produced a robust immune response in both animals and children, temporarily heartening researchers, but then tragically killing the vaccine recipients upon re-exposure to the wild virus or making them vulnerable to uniquely debilitating infections. Early in 2020, vaccinology's most brass-bound commissars warned of this pitfall as Dr. Fauci unleashed the industry with billions in federal lucre to gin up COVID inoculations at record pace. In his March 5, 2020 testimony before the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee on Coronavirus, Bill Gates's paid mouthpiece, Dr. Peter Hotez, cautioned, "One of the things we're not hearing a lot about is the unique potential safety problem of coronavirus vaccines. With certain types of respiratory virus vaccines, you get immunized, and then, when you get actually exposed to the virus, you get this kind of paradoxical immune enhancement phenomenon." Dr. Hotez confessed to the committee that his colleagues had killed a number of children from pathogenic priming during experiments with the respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, vaccines in 1966, and recounted that during his own earlier work on coronavirus vaccines, he saw the same effect on ferrets. "We started developing coronavirus vaccines, and our colleagues, we noticed in laboratory animals that they started to show some of the same immune pathology. So we said, oh my God, this is going to be problematic." In an April 26, 2020 interview with pharma troll Dr. Zubin Z-Dog Damania, MD, Merck's top vaccine promoter, Dr. Paul Offit amplified these concerns. "Binding antibodies can be dangerous and cause something called antibody-dependent enhancement, and we've seen that. I mean, we saw that with the Gates-funded dengue vaccine. But with the dengue vaccine, in children who had never been exposed to dengue before, it actually made them worse when they were then exposed to the natural virus. Much worse. Vaccinated children who were less than 9 years of age, who had never been exposed to dengue before, were more likely to die if they'd been vaccinated than if they hadn't been vaccinated." And even Dr. Anthony Fauci, during his March 26, 2020 White House coronavirus briefing, acknowledge the perils of pathogenic priming. "The issue of safety is something I want to make sure the American public understands. Does the vaccine make you worse? And there are diseases in which you vaccinate someone, they get infected with what you're trying to protect them with, and you actually enhance the infection. That's the worst possible thing you could do, is vaccinate somebody to prevent infection and actually make them worse." Dr. Fauci must have recognized that since vaccine makers had immunity from liability, which he had helped arrange, and were playing, as it were, with house money, which he diverted to them through NIH, these companies had little incentive to invest in the kind of long-term studies necessary to eliminate the pathogenic priming hazard. In retrospect, it seems that Dr. Fauci and his confederates had at least 6 strategies for dealing with this grim risk. All six tactics involved hiding the evidence of ADE if it did occur. Dr. Fauci's first approach was to abort the 3-year clinical trials at 6 months and then vaccinate the controls, a preemption that would prevent detection of long-term injuries, including pathogenic priming. Regulators initially intended the Pfizer vaccine trial to continue for 3 full years until May 2, 2023. Because the FDA allowed Pfizer to unblind and terminate its study after 6 months, and to offer the vaccine to individuals in the placebo group, we will never know whether vaccinated individuals in the trial suffered long-term injuries, including pathogenic priming, that canceled out short-term benefits. Science and experience tell us that many vaccines can cause injuries like cancers, autoimmune diseases, allergies, fertility problems, and neurological illnesses with long-term diagnostic horizons or long incubation periods. A 6-month study will hide these harms. Second, as COVID czar, Dr. Fauci stubbornly refused to fix HHS's designed-to-fail vaccine injury surveillance system, VAERS, which systematically suppresses reporting of most vaccine injuries. The Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System is a passive, voluntary system, jointly managed by the CDC and FDA, that accepts reports from anyone. A 2010 HHS study of the government's notoriously dysfunctional VAERS concluded that VAERS detects fewer than 1% of vaccine injuries. Put another way, VAERS misses over 99% of vaccine injuries, thereby lending the illusion of safety to even the most deadly inoculations. In 2010, the Federal Agency for Healthcare Research Quality, AHRQ, designed and field-tested a state-of-the-art machine-counting AI system as an efficient alternative to VAERS. By testing the system for several years on the Harvard Pilgrim HMO, AHRQ proved that it could capture most vaccine injuries.